Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. Today, we're going to look at Matthew's version of the resurrection story. The Gospels don't exactly, are not able to be harmonized so that they all say the same thing. There's a variety of different experiences and a variety of different perceptions and of different stories concerning the resurrection itself. There's some fundamental truth, some fundamental reality to it that all four Gospels share. But the details about the recognition, the seeing of Jesus, the acknowledgement of the resurrection, and so forth, vary from Gospel to Gospel. Is there a good reason for this? Well, maybe not a good reason, but there is a reason. First of all, the early Christian community did not anticipate a resurrection of the body. That if we recall and go back and listen to the things that Jesus has been telling his disciples, they always seem to be obtuse. They always seem to be concerned and distracted about other things that may sound familiar to us who hear the word of God and who are supposed to be attentive to the deeper meaning of it. But oftentimes ourselves are distracted, and oftentimes our minds cluttered with other thoughts and other needs and other experiences. We remember the time, for instance, that Jesus was telling about his death and his he was going to die and going to be turned over to the chief priest. He was going to suffer and die and then rise on the third day. And the disciples are all listening to this while they're arguing about who's more important and which one is going to share in the kingdom, that when it is right and when it is left. Remembering that the apostles were still very much imbued with the cultural expectations of who the Messiah would be. Part of the reason, of course, for the messianic secret that we hear. For if, in fact, people testified to Jesus as Messiah, they would set up expectations from popular perceptions and popular understanding. And when Jesus did not fulfill those expectations would become a stumbling block to belief in him, a stumbling block to discipleship. So that the false witness to Jesus is more harmful in many ways than no witness at all. And so the story goes on then, in the many times that Jesus makes reference to his resurrection, just as many times the disciples are unaware of the whole thing, uncomprehending of it, and kind of unable to cope with it or deal with it, not having any idea whatsoever what it might in fact mean. We have another argument or another series of discussion that goes on about the resurrection of the Lord. Something very, very popular in the mid part of the last century that, well, we're talking about a spiritual resurrection, then Jesus the person, not necessarily Jesus the body, rose from the dead. And that so too we ourselves will leave behind our mortal remains as we in some way, shape, or form join the Lord. But the teaching of the church is always contrary to that, and for good reason. Because in any kind of culture, and particularly in the culture of the first century, any distinction between a person and the person's corporeal reality was incomprehensible and unthinkable. They never, ever thought of a person without thinking of the person in their human form, in their corporeal form. For them to say the spirit of Jesus rose from the dead, but the body did not, would have been an incomprehensible concept for them. Such a thing was simply impossible to in any way, shape, or form, to believe or to understand what it might mean. We can even go back into the prophet Ezekiel in the story of the dry bones, that even when the body has decayed and even when the body is gone and all that's left of the skeletal remains of the dead, Ezekiel says, you know, that God can rebuild the human person in a corporeal sort of way and put into them a living spirit. So this idea that in very kind of pseudo-sophisticated discussions about the doubting of the physical resurrection of Jesus as actually not very sophisticated and actually has had very little comprehension of the mindset, the language, the cultural milieu of the first century Palestine. So that what we can do here is believe and realize that when we speak of, when we see the evidence in the Gospels of the empty tomb, we are talking about the fact that Jesus as a whole person has risen from the dead, that he is not risen in parts and pieces, that he is, in fact, the total risen Lord, Jesus of Nazareth, second person of the Blessed Trinity, Son of God. In the Catholic Church, we maintain within the doctrinal tradition that we have that in the final judgment, that all of our bodies will rise and be glorified, and that we will stand before the Lord as whole persons, as those who came forth from his creative hand, but in a glorified manner, exactly as Jesus seems to be difficult to recognize in his risen form and his glorified form. The second thing that the Gospels are not consistent with is who were the first witnesses to the person of Jesus risen from the dead? Who were they? Well, there's a variety of here it is Mary Magdalene and the other Mary. In John's Gospel, it is Mary Magdalene. But in Hebrew tradition, a witness is not an experience. A witness is a formal reality. And in John's Gospel, he makes it somewhat clear that the first official witness of the resurrection is Peter. Mary Magdalene reports that the tomb is empty, and she runs into Jesus as the gardener. She thinks he's the gardener in the garden. Then she runs and tells the disciples, and they come. But there is a difference between what Mary Magdalene has experienced and what Peter and John have witnessed to. For it is not the word of Mary Magdalene, but the word of Peter that ensures the fact that the risen Christ is part of the Christian tradition. Now, this might seem to us, and you can say, well, you know, that's just being anti-woman or something. It's no such thing. It's how the society functioned. If you recall that there are always references to witnesses within any kind of Judaic juridical process in the New Testament, you have to have witnesses, and you have to have witnesses who are official, who are formal witnesses. And once you have that, you even see that, for instance, in the story of Susanna in the book of Daniel, that the witnesses happen to be corrupt and happen to be the ones who, in their rage against her virtue, want to see her dead. But their word is taken because they are the official witnesses. So too is it in the New Testament. And that is that Peter becomes, in all of the Gospels, the official witness to the risen Lord, the official witness to the empty tomb, the one on whose testimony the belief is founded and based. So we can argue, was it Mary Magdalene? Was it Mary Magdalene and the other Mary? Who was it then that first experienced the presence of the risen Lord? But when we talk about who was the first witness to the risen Lord, every gospel in its own way confirms that that is Peter. And fact is, Father Kessler of Columbus wrote his doctoral dissertation on Peter as the first witness to the resurrection in the New Testament. And it's a very thorough and very learned study, and one that's worthwhile to become familiar with. Because with the whole gender battle that's going on in contemporary society, people say, well, the first witness to the resurrection was a woman. And in John's Gospel, the first one to experience the presence of Christ after the resurrection was a woman. The first one to officially witness to it was Peter, followed, and even in that, John makes it very clear that John does not go in the tomb because that's not his role. Peter is the leader. It is his testimony which is going to inform the faith of the disciples. And so he has to be the one then formally witnesses to the empty tomb. With all that being said, and put that aside, because that's not really what this is all about, it's an incidental, and it tells us, in fact, how this belief in the resurrection became embedded in the Christian kerygma, in the apostolic proclamation. It becomes embedded in the apostolic proclamation through the witness of Peter. Then what happens, even though Peter might not have been the first to experience the presence of the risen Lord? So, then in this, the women, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, come at once. There was a violent earthquake. We get this earthquake again. The idea that this is dramatic, this is explosive. This is something that shakes the created order to its very foundation. The very kind of experience of a severe earthquake is the shaking of the world to its very foundation. And so what has happened now is so dramatic that the earth trembles from it. The earth is shaken by the reality of the risen Lord. And then once again in Matthew, the angel comes, as the angel came to Joseph and to enable him, in Matthew's gospel, to take Mary as his wife and also to flee into Egypt. So now the angel comes again to announce to the women I know you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has been risen as he said he would. Come and see the place where he lay, and then go and tell his disciples. He is risen from the dead and is now going before you to Galilee. It is there that you will see him. So what we have, all sorts of complications here too. In this particular one, we know that in one of the Gospels, the women are saying, well, if we're going to go and anoint the body, if that's what's going to happen, they're worried about who's going to roll the stone back. Well, here it is, an earthquake rolls the stone back, and an angel sits upon the stone in order to inform the women of what has happened. They would not necessarily recognize the event for what it was had it not been proclaimed to them by the angel. In that sense, the first witness to the risen Lord is the angel who sits upon the stone that was rolled back from the mouth of the grave, of the tomb. And so he says, now go and tell them that he will go to Galilee, and that's where his disciples will see him. Again, discrepancy in the Gospels. In John's Gospel, the reappearances seem to take place in Jerusalem, which for John is the center of the whole ministry of the Lord, basically. In others, it was presumed, reasonable, that the disciples, now knowing that their leader had been murdered, had been subjected to a kangaroo court through the darkness of the night and railroaded onto a crucifix, onto a cross, that they obviously would think it was best to get out of Jerusalem. And since they were all from Galilee, it was also reasonable that further away they could be from Jerusalem, the better, and go back home and resume their lives again and see what then would happen. Now, this then is the basic structure of the story of the resurrection. The important thing for us is to recognize and to realize in all of this that the foundation of the Christian faith, and Paul says this, if Christ had not risen from the dead, then everything that we say is in vain, that it doesn't mean anything, which is why the easiest place to attack the Christian faith is in the denial of the resurrection, either in a pseudo-sophisticated way by denying the rising of the body, or in simply the old the old way of dismissing something, which is simply to ridicule the Christian belief in the resurrection and the continuing presence of Jesus in our lives. Like they say, the instruments of modern secularism, especially in the major media, are masters of this technique. Totally unsuccessful among those who believe, totally successful among those who do not. So they play to their own crowd. But the idea for us of the importance of the risen Lord has deep, deep dimensions. Not just that we say Jesus has been raised from the dead. He has risen from the dead. He lives. He has gone before them into Galilee. We know the story of them encountering him on the beach as they're out fishing. We know the story of his appearances to them in the closed upper room where they're hiding for fear of the Jews in John's gospel. And we see it in Luke's as well, where they become terrified when they see him as risen because they have no concept what that was all about. And Jesus has to tell them, I'm not a ghost. And then he tells them, give me something to eat. I'm real. I am not pure spirit. I am real. I am together. I am both the living God and the human person, Jesus. For this is who I am to you to the end of time. And so this Catholic belief in the continuing presence of the incarnation, of the incarnate Christ within our life and our world, within our church, and as the essence and the core and the root of our sacramental life, is the presence of the incarnate Christ. It makes us radically different from other forms of Christianity that ascribe to Jesus only the world of pure spirit. And no longer encounter him in the materiality of the created order, which was the essence and the significance of the incarnation. Behold, I am with you all days and to the consummation of the world. I have come and become part of this which I have created, and I will remain that until the world is no more. With that, then, we find that we have to ask ourselves the question, what about our Christian faith? For these days, the Christian faith is deeply challenged. That it is, and it, since it stands for the integrity of the human person, it becomes at enmity with much of the modern secular world. Even people within our own church have abandoned the idea of the incarnate Christ and have bought the secular propaganda spewed forth by media, by politicians, and so forth, many of them who falsely bear the name Catholic. These are troubled and difficult times. What does it mean for us? What is the foundation of our faith? Is it simply my childhood memories? Is it practices of piety? Is it somehow or other that I like to swim around in what I presume or perceive to be a spiritual world? What is the attraction of the faith? And I think in truly in the form of the incarnate Christ, it burrows deep, deep, deep into the meaning of the human person, into the human psyche, into the fundamental human experience of life. I remember many, many decades ago, in the popular, in the times of the late 50s and throughout the 60s, during the rage of the great popularity of the French existentialists, of Jean-Paul Sartre, of Albert Camus especially, and I remember the fascination that it had for young people, that it was because they both posed fundamental questions. Sartre less interesting in some ways, simply because he was more political, I guess. But others would disagree with me on that, of course. But Camus kind of struggled for the essence of the human person. What was it? And he, of course, devoid of belief in the resurrection of Jesus, came to the conclusion that the only meaning there was, for instance, in his book, The Plague, was honor. The doctor in The Plague, in Camus' novel, is the one then who reveals the inner essence of what it means to be truly human, and that he was an honorable man. He was a man of honor. A virtue that might transcend the individual, but which does not preserve the individual from ceasing to be. And so as young people, we might have been fascinated with those questions. What is this struggle? Is there really, it sounds trite to say this, but is there really a deeper and inner meaning of life? And I think that for many of us, as we swam in the French existentialist world, looking for and grasping after a deeper understanding of the human person, you have to come back, if you are a believer, you have to come back to the fundamental difference between Christianity and the rest of humanity is the virtue of hope. And the virtue of hope is not an abstract idea floating around in the world. It is through the scriptures and through the experiential life of the church, preserving the sense of the presence of the incarnate Christ. It is, in fact, a concrete reality. It is a concrete reality that is not an elusive concept, and it does not have an undefined end to it. For the human mind cannot create for itself an end to hope that is witnessed to and that is supported by the experience of the presence of the divine within the created order. The resurrection is the guarantee, the guarantor of the human capacity for an authentic, truly human hope for oneself, for one's family, for one's friends, for all humanity itself. We are not struggling towards some kind of an abstract ideal. We are struggling for the continued existence of the human person as a whole person into an eternal moment of fulfillment and joy. That is confirmed and that is existentially proclaimed in the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the witness of the disciples, of the women and of the apostles at the tomb, that Jesus Christ has risen and has appeared to the others. It says he has risen and he has appeared to Peter. He enters the room in John 20, all the door is closed. And then in the second time tells Thomas, touch me and see, I am real. I am not a ghost. He says in Luke, I am not a ghost. He says on the seashore in Galilee, give me something to eat. Let us, and he was cooking breakfast when they arrived. There is the man, the human being, Jesus of Nazareth, risen from the dead so that body is no longer present on earth, except united to the person of the divine and existentially present in the world of human experience. That is hope. For us to simply say, and this is something interesting that Camus was very adamant about. He was very, very adamant about the essential danger of purely abstract ideas. They had lived through the world of the Nazi ideology and of the communist ideology, and they saw that abstract ideals became instruments of tyranny. And that the only way, we see that at work even in our own society today, separated from the risen Christ, we have those who seek existential goals, and those who seek strange and abstract ideas. The one who seeks strange and abstract ideas are the ones who deep in their hearts desire to be tyrants. We see that, for instance, in Hugo Chavez, in Nicolas Maduro, in Venezuela. We see it in Fidel Castro, in Cuba. We see it in this strange mixture of the world in China itself, given birth by Mao Zedong, and yet somehow or other surviving as a masterful and tyrannical presence, seeking only material prosperity and not the fulfillment and the growth of the human person, the human spirit, the human soul and body together. And so Camus, in rejecting abstraction as a PowerPoint within the human history and human experience, not being privy to the existential experience within the Catholic Church of the presence of the incarnate Christ, could find no further meaning in the human person than what their behavior was in this life, but that too, with their death, would pass away. The resurrection as a reality, as an existential presence, as an existential fact, is necessary for human hope to be grounded in a goodness of life, in a generosity of spirit, and not in a quest for raw power and domination and tyranny. The resurrection frees us from the necessity of absolutizing our experience on earth and letting that experience float freely in the waves of history, connected with the created order of whom God himself has become a part, remains present to us and with us, and lives within the sacramental life of the Church. St. Francis of Assisi, interestingly enough, never referred to Jesus Christ in any separate sort of way, except in relationship to church and sacrament. Aside from that, it was always the Most High God. Aside from that, it was always the Trinity. We might learn from him the great importance of our conviction that the risen Lord is not pure spirit. He is not a ghost, but he is present incarnationally among us in the materiality of the life of the Church and in the materiality of the sacramental life of the Church. And that as such, the incarnation persists as a guiding light for us, a strength for us, a renewing spirit within us until the culmination of the world. Let us move beyond the foolishness of secularism, the emptiness and the shallowness of it. Appreciate those people who have dug deep for meaning and learn then the power of this gospel story that the Lord is truly risen. He is among us. He is with us. He is Emmanuel.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.
Veni, Sancte.